Hello, listeners. Happy New Year's Eve from Ben and myself. Ben is here also.
Yes, Ben is here. He's also
sipping some eggnog and preparing, warming up to sing Auld Lang Syne. And our New Year's gift to you is this special episode you're about to listen to, featuring some of our favourite moments from the podcast we've recorded over the last 12 months. It's a best of 2018 episode.
Yeah, just so you know, we are recording this in a kitchen surrounded by half-empty bottles of spirits, whilst other people in a room next door are having a much better time than us.
Yes, the fireworks have already gone off. It is not yet midnight.
Yes, the fireworks went off in the dog basket.
If you are a first-time listener and you've decided to dive in, hello, welcome to the podcast. We hope the next 35 minutes will give you a flavour of what we're about. If you're a long-time listener, then hopefully you'll recognise some familiar voices from the past year. The episode features clips with Jack Bernhardt, Stephen Colgan, Lydia Mizen, James Barr and Dan Hudson from A Gay and a Non-Gay, Francesco De Carlo, Lord Fear, aka Tom Bell, Joel Morris, Glenn Moore, Bex Lindsay, Taylor Glenn, Anuvab Pal, Paul Duncan McGarrity, and Tristan Bernays.
And one thoroughly ridiculous wasp gun.
Thank you very much for listening. Happy New Year!
Merry New Year!
I am choosing Félix François Faure, the President of France from 1895 to 1899, purely for one reason and one reason only,
okay.
As you will soon hear. He was president during the start of the Dreyfus Affair, which is a very famous case of miscarriage of justice. He also was noted for how he received the Tsar in 1896, and in 1897 he was in charge during the resumption of the Franco-Russian alliance. So, you know, he did some good stuff. He died in office on the 16th of February 1899 of an apoplexy at the Élysée Palace while his mistress was sucking his dick.
Whoa!
So, So what, your guy who died, your fictional guy who died while having sex. Yep, this is the real dude.
Love it.
And he started an affair in 1897 with this woman called Marguerite Stenheil. She was the one who was fellating him at the time, so they say, politely, fellating him while he died. It was while they were having sex. All the puns afterwards seem to suggest it was definitely because she was blowing him.
Okay.
For example, after he died, there was a lot of snickering, as you can imagine. Huh. She was given the nickname La Pompe Funèbre, which is a French term meaning sort of the pomp of funerals, or the ceremony and the care of funerals. But pompe is also a word meaning to suck off. So
that's a good
literally
pun.
The death pump.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of French puns in these guys. Georges Clemenceau, who later went on to be the Prime Minister of France, he was a journalist at the time, and he said, again, in French, so you'll spot where the pun comes, guys, he wished to be Caesar, but ended up as Pompey. He wanted to be Caesar, but ended up being blown. And he also said in an article in one of Clemenceau's newspapers, he said, upon entering the void, he must have felt at home.
That's a great epitaph.
The best bit about it is that when the priest showed up at the Élysée Palace, he asked one of the attendants to issue the last rites. He said, a-t-il toujours sa connaissance? Meaning, does he still have his faculties? Is he still aware? Connaissance can also be translated as his acquaintance. So he might have just asked, is his acquaintance still here? Which is why he was answered by a servant going, no, she left via the service.
Oh my god. It's a farce. It's so good.
It's so funny. And the epilogue is so good. In 1908, a boat called the President Félix Faure sank near New Zealand, and the survivors spent 60 days stranded on an island until they were rescued, meaning that 10 years after he died, François Faure went down yet again.
Yay!
I mean, these cops at that time, they were on 3 shillings a week. They were expected to work 7 days a week without meal breaks. And they were expected to even sleep in their uniform just in case someone needed them. I mean, it really was, you know. And on top, which everyone hated them. The working class hated them. Yeah. The toffs liked to steal their helmets and piss on them from the top of the building. You know, you've only got to read a bit of P.G. Woodhouse to see how the police officers got dealt with at the time. But you find some amazing things like a PC Rogers in 1830 who was dismissed for being drunk and fighting with a woman in Tufton Road and abusing PC Clark and pulling off his coat to fight him. You know, that's a regular dismissal. Or Francis Masters in 1840 was jailed for endeavouring to stab his sergeant with a pocket knife who was trying to take his beer off him.
I've read the first 2,800 people who joined the police force, the Peelers, only 600 of them kept their jobs. And you know the way police get numbers when they join the force?
They do.
Number one lasted 4 hours and was dismissed for drunkenness.
Isn't that great?
My God, it's like a Royal Rumble, isn't it?
It was staggering. I mean, it just goes on and on. Frederick Wilding found in a tap room, drunk and wildly dancing while on duty.
I mean, his surname just
Frederick Wilding, yeah.
suggests.
When under the influence and coming off duty, drunk before his superintendent and under the influence of liquor before the commissioner. Yeah, the double whammy there. I think my fate. Oh, some here. Complaint by publican of constable making water in a spittoon in front of his bar. Or in 1893, a PC Holmes making water on top of a cistern. Which I thought quite clever, actually, I think.
He must have been very tall.
Well, the cisterns were very high. I think he was doing one of those. Worse. But yeah, he was sacked for highly improper and for being highly improper and filthy. You get others that were. It was a PC Jones in the same year who was suspended so that he can have a bath and cleanse himself before he came back to duty. But
I can't have to suspend you because you're going to need to bat a week's worth of cleaning.
Yeah. But my absolute favourite is a guy called PC Clears, who, apart from being in a filthy state from vermin and not cleansing himself as directed, was sacked for this brilliant offence of drunkenness. He was sacked for being absent from his beat and found drunk and asleep with his head through a pane of glass in a greenhouse. Now he is my top cop. Anyone who can get so drunk they can stick their head through a pane of glass in a greenhouse and stay asleep and be in a verminous state, got to be best cop ever.
A fat and jolly red-faced man, the red is from the tomatoes he planted his face into.
Oh, the blood. Oh, so much blood. Yeah, so PC Clears would get my vote just because that's a staggering thing to be sacked for. Oh, I got sacked again, dear. What for? Greenhouse this time.
Next, let me tell you about Alberto. Alberto was a contestant on the Spanish show Ahora Caigo, which is an American version, a Spanish version of the American show Who's Still Standing.
Lydia's smiling. I just read about this. Already, yes. I haven't heard of this.
So he was asked the question, what is Steve Rogers in the Avengers? Is he a doctor, a sir, or a captain? Is Steve Rogers in the Avengers a doctor, a sir, or a captain? Mm-hmm. Not the easiest of questions if you're not a comic book fan. He answered a doctor, which would have been a 1 out of 3 blunder, were it not for the fact that he were wearing a Captain America t-shirt.
Oh, no.
Yup.
Oh, no.
And the blunder cost him more than $150,000
in prize money. That's so bad. I think that is 70-odd episodes in bed. I think that is my favourite story you've ever told.
He then proceeded to propose to his girlfriend on camera.
No!
And I don't know whether he was planning to do it not already, or whether he was just going, I have tremendously fucked up, so I'm just going
to save the room.
Yeah.
Tell me she said no.
I can only presume that she didn't.
I think she said yes, because I read this as well, but I mean, you would, wouldn't you, just to save his feelings, and then later you go, well, we could have had a nice wedding, couldn't we?
Yeah.
Dan isn't single, but I'd take the grenade for Dan.
Right.
If I had
What does that mean?
Well, like, if we were on a night out and you fancied a girl and she had like an ugly gay friend.
Right.
Sorry to the ugly gay friend. Then I'd probably like distract the ugly gay friend.
Right. Yeah.
I'd take the grenade.
Would you though? Because you'd be caught up in your own situation on the other side of the club.
Yeah, because I'd be like eyeing up the barman.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I'd somehow find a way to like flirt with the barman and and take the grenade.
I appreciate that.
Or maybe like arrange a threesome or something between us.
Would Dan then have to distract the ugly gay friend so you could get with the barman? Would you do that, Dan?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I would do that probably as a matter of course anyway.
Okay. So what am I...
Go on. No. Because I'm not single, so I don't have any interest in like chatting to people in a club anyway, other than like, you know, actually socially. So like I do end up doing that all the time for various people, like straight and not because
yeah,
go on.
One of my best friends who will remain nameless, is straight, non-gay. And he and I went out one night, and he literally did take the grenade from me, and he got off with a guy.
Really?
For me. So that I could get off with his friend. Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? And then he came up to me and was like, he bought me a drink. I'm so excited.
Like, we're going to Fire Island next week.
Yeah, and now he's like, he's married, he's totally non-gay, but yeah, he was like, that was such a funny night.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? Would you do that, Dan?
No.
Okay. It's really sweet seeing straight guys being hit on and sort of enjoying it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I am not used to this at all, but it is a delight.
I got bought a beer. Yeah. Wow.
Actually, I have to buy the beers for
yeah.
them.
All the stories about Hitler's depravity in the Nazi Party, a lot of them probably emanated from the political wartime executive, otherwise known as Her Majesty's Pornographers, or His Majesty's Pornographers. One of the leaders of this group is a man called Sefton Delmer, who was a journalist for the Daily Express. He was their Berlin correspondent before the war, so he was fluent in German and knew a lot of the high-ranking members of the Nazi Party. And this group was based out of a farm in Hertfordshire. And
what went on that farm?
Well, Ben, let me tell you. They had artists, including a lady called Marion Whitehorn, doctor photos of the Führer to make it look like he had his dick out in public, or just to make it look like he was sitting in a chair wanking himself off, which they would distribute across Germany.
No, I can't
genuinely
believe this.
This is true, and none of these exist because a lot of it was destroyed afterwards. Marion Whitehorn was on record as saying that she was told in no uncertain terms that if she ever told anyone what she was doing, she would end up in prison. That they were this was not to be allowed out, and no one was to know what was going on. The SS denounced some of these all of these photos, of course, as forgeries. So Sefton Delmer hit on the idea of issuing a forgery of those SS pamphlets, decrying them as forgeries. So he issued his fake forgeries of these pamphlets saying, look, this picture of Hitler with a massive dick, because they're doing with a massive dick, is clearly a forgery. We all know the Führer has a small dick. But my world's worst prank comes from their establishment of Gustav Siegfried Eins, which was a pirate radio station they set up. And again, this was broadcasting from the farm in Hartz, but it was broadcast across Berlin and Germany. This radio station, Gustav Siegfried Eins, proclaimed itself to be a voice of the far-right Nazi dissidents. He was saying that Hitler isn't going far enough and that the leaders of the Nazi Party are depraved, they're all into hookers and they're gay and they're Jew lovers and all of these things. And this led to a British politician saying, if this is the sort of thing needed to win the war, well, I'd rather lose it, frankly. Word got back to Roosevelt. In Washington, the Americans prepared a report for Roosevelt saying, oh, there is a dissident Nazi radio station. When the Brits told Roosevelt that it was actually one of their ruses, Roosevelt was apparently reported to be delighted.
Like, properly delighted.
Probably thought, this is brilliant. And the radio station broadcast from May 1941 till October 1943, but its final broadcast leads me to think that maybe it wasn't the finest prank ever. They decided to hit on the idea that they would have the announcer speaking and then a Gestapo officer burst in and the radio audience to hear the sound of an argument and a fight breaking out and the Gestapo officer saying, I have you now, and shooting the announcer. And that would be the end of the radio station because they felt, okay, people have kind of cottoned on. And so they broadcast that episode. Then they accidentally ran it an hour later again.
Oh, no. Wow, and that was the invention of plus one TV channels.
Look away now if you don't want to see the results.
Ramesses II, here he is. Eighth ever most children in the world.
Wow.
Pretty good.
That's not bad.
And I was
who's first?
Well, this is it. I wonder if you guys can.
Is it Attila
hazard a guess?
Or Genghis Khan? One of the two of them had like 300 kids.
Well, that's it.
I know the soul singer Solomon Burke had about 50.
Oh, really? Give us a benchmark. How many did Ramesses have?
Okay, let me bring it up. 162 plus is the.
Oh, wow. Okay,
pretty
that's a
good.
High bar.
Pretty good.
I can't remember if it's Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan.
No, well, I'm going to give absolutely points. It was Genghis Khan, number one.
Genghis Khan, number one, nice.
Number one with a bullet. Oh, Geng. Between
how did he get anything else done?
The official, they've got written here, between 1,000 and 2,000.
Jesus Christ. Mm,
busy man.
Yeah, well, it's surely.
And they spent their lives on horseback.
But a very
a lot of those horses got pregnant.
Well. That's right.
Yes, we don't know how many of these are all horse children.
That's very good.
But then I went down a few more. I was like, I wonder if there's... I was like, we can't do Gainers because he's too successful to be, you know... And then there was this chap stood out, Augustus II, brackets the Strong. And I'm always like anybody who was...
gives himself a nickname.
Name.
Yeah.
And I was like, who's this? Augustus was Elector Saxony, King of Poland.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, right, let's have a look at this. Went to Augustus II. When was he around? Well, we all know at home, but just in case...
Oh, yeah, we all...
1670 to 1733.
Yeah, that was right in the tips of our tongue.
Yeah, exactly. Right in the old 18th century, famously one of the most boring periods of history. But I went down his thing. I was like, is he going to be a good one? He seemed quite boring. And then it talked about one of his hobbies being, here we go, Augustus' great physical strength earned him the nicknames the Strong, the Saxon Hercules, and the Iron Hand, which are all great, and I really need to get myself some more nicknames.
Yeah.
And he liked to show how strong he was... by breaking horseshoes with his bare hands and engaging in fox tossing. Well, guess where I went after that. Reader, I went to fox tossing.
And please tell me throwing foxes rather than...
Yes. Fuchs Berlin. German. And I was like, I hope that's... It is.
Wow.
It's a popular competitive blood sport in parts of Europe, 17th, 18th century, which involved throwing a live fox in the air.
Jesus
particularly
Christ.
Popular for mixed couples, which is nice.
Oh, nice. That's good.
Because you'd have single fox tossing, doubles, and then the mixed
speed
doubles.
Speed dating fox tossing.
Yes, exactly. That's how you do it.
And that's poor bloody foxes, as if being hunted isn't bad enough.
Would you rather be tossed or hunted?
I don't know. I like to be hunted and then tossed.
But we're going to the 70s, and we're going to a film that directed by Ken Russell, starring Roger Daltrey.
I'm feeling something good brewing.
Yeah. This is Roger Daltrey, of course, as the star of Tommy, the mock opera. Yeah. But it's not Tommy. It's Listomania.
Yeah! This sounds amazing.
What is Listomania? Okay, so my brain has instantly gone, a musical about the life of Joseph Lister.
It is a musical about the life of 19th century composer Franz Liszt.
Yay!
Sorry, the Who's Roger Daltrey?
Yes!
Perfect casting.
Pinball wizard to... Franz Liszt.
Derived in part from a kiss and tell book by Marie de Ajoul, who about to have an affair with Liszt.
What?
Everyone wanted this musical. Everyone was waiting
for it. Are you kidding me?
This reminds me, because I had a theory about Andrew Lloyd Webber, that his entire career was like the producers.
Yeah.
That he'd started off, he'd gone, what would lose money? And they went, what about the Bible? Okay, what about doing the Bible again? What about doing right-wing dictators? What about everyone's dressed as cats? Everyone's a train. Like the Northern Ireland Trouble. I've got to lose money somehow. And they keep accidentally being hits. And this sounds like it's come from the same thing, going, oh, no one's talking about Franz Liszt's affair. Let's make a musical of it. It's all a huge tax dodge.
Of all the people who've had affairs, here a decade after JFK and Marilyn Monroe.
This is sizzling hot.
Strap in, because this is the sanest thing I'm going to say in the next 5 minutes.
No.
So, they depict Liszt as the first classical pop star. This is a decade before
this is
Amadeus.
This is a big performer.
Yep. The soundtrack is composed by Rick Wakeman from Yes, obviously. And it includes synthesizer arrangements of works by Liszt and Wagner.
Yeah.
Wakeman also appears in the film as the Nordic god of thunder, Thor.
They didn't get him for the Marvel. Idiots.
Yes. There are other...
We've got it down to two. We've got Chris Hemsworth and Rick Wakeman.
What do they look like with their tops on? Yeah.
There is another rock celebrity in Listomania. We've already mentioned him. It's Ringo Starr.
Yeah, of course he is. And there's the hat trick.
And Ringo Starr is playing the Pope.
The role he was born to play.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, we've had a Pope John Paul. We haven't had a George. We've had a Ringo.
Pope Ringo the First. Rather than presenting a straightforward narrative, the film tells his life...
Oh, good.
Yeah. Through a series...
Who likes straightforward narratives? If we've learned nothing over the last hour, it's nobody.
A series of surrealistic episodes blending fact and fantasy and full of anachronisms. At the start of the film, List is caught in bed with Marie d'Ajol by her husband, the Count d'Ajol. The Count then orders his staff to trap List and Marie into the body of a piano, nailing it shut and leaving it on railroad tracks.
That's so Laurel and Hardy.
What year is this? Huh? What, this is the 1800s. This
yes.
Is the, so the railways were going at what, like 10 miles an hour at this
yeah.
point?
Yeah, they're just going to nudge the piano along the tracks. This scene is then shown to be a flashback triggered by the camera flash of photographers backstage before one of List's concerts. That's right, photographers are one of List's concerts. Right.
So it's a bit like Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, sure.
Very, very like that.
Right, yeah. Then Richard Wagner appears and List introduces him to a circle of colleagues, including people like Rossini, Berlioz, Chopin. At the concert, Wagner is really turned off List by his crowd-pleasing showmanship at the expense of serious musicianship. Which,
to be fair, there's one thing that Wagner isn't. It's crowd-pleasing. Unless that crowd is at Nuremberg.
Yeah,
he's more crowd-pleasing.
He gets pissed off at List because List shows off by adding the melody of Chopsticks to his variation. But the crowd love it. It's full of screaming girls. They can completely nuts. And List uses like his reputation from this concert to proposition potentially wealthy females in the audience, including Princess Caroline. We then go to Russia, where List meets her at her court, and she begins to seduce him in one of the weirdest scenes in the movie. Bear in mind what I've said so far.
Yeah.
He experiences a hallucination where the women of Princess Caroline's court assail him, but then becomes seduced by his music, which strokes his libido and gives him a 10-foot erection.
Is that a bassoon in your pocket? Yeah. Pleased to see me.
No, no coherent narrative, but it does have a 10-foot cock. Erection.
I'm in. Yeah. It's what he said from the next room.
The women then drag List and his erection to a guillotine.
Pretends as he wants to lose first.
Yeah, exactly. Caroline reveals that the bargain for his newfound music ability is to forfeit his life of a libertine. So then we then go to the May Uprising in Dresden.
What's this film missing? The May Uprising in Dresden.
Yeah. Wagner is now a political criminal. As List tends to Wagner's wounds, Wagner secretly drugs List, who passes out.
Oh.
Wagner then reveals himself to be a vampire.
good.
Wow.
With a mission to write music that will inspire new German nationalism. He then proceeds to suck List's blood and compose on the piano. Before departing, Wagner leaves him his latest political pamphlet, which is obviously a Superman comic written by Friedrich Nietzsche.
What the fuck is going on?
God, holy
shit. How many days can you get out of one machina?
Yeah. What else happens in this? List.
I think I'm getting the feeling it'd be quicker to tell us what doesn't happen. Yeah.
Okay, other things that occur.
Yeah.
Just as a highlight, List becomes an abbot.
Whilst
an abbot, he's caught in bed with a woman. And then the Pope has to explain that Wagner...
Pope Ringo explains
that Wagner has been seduced by Cosima as his wife and has begun to lead a devilish cult organised around his music. He tasks List with travelling to Wagner's castle to exorcise the devil from Wagner and return him to the Christian faith, or else List will be excommunicated and his music banned.
I tell you what, at least it's not restating the same stakes over and over again.
List travels to Wagner's castle, where he observes a secret ritual portraying a devilish Jew raping several blonde-haired Germanic nymphs. Wagner appears with Cosima, dressed in Superman outfits,
yes.
And sings about how, and I quote, the flowering of youth of Germany was raped by the beast, and that a new messiah will soon arrive to drive out that beast. At the conclusion of the song, Cosima marches the audience, composed entirely of children, out with a Nazi salute as they chant about how they will be the master race.
Oh, wow. I love a film with a happy ending.
I feel like I've had a stroke and I can't, you know, like, you're actually just saying normal words and I'm hearing something completely different.
Can you smell burnt toast?
Yeah. Yes.
Later on, Wagner is killed and then subsequently resurrected in a Nazi ceremony as a Frankenstein Hitler wielding a machine gun guitar.
Mercy, I'll tell you where the fucking plans are. Just let me go.
Trapped, List observes that as Cosima leads the Wagner Hitler to gun down the town's Jews, after which she kills List by stabbing a needle through the heart of a voodoo doll. It's like this.
What?
The film concludes in heaven.
No, of course it does.
Where List is reunited with the women he romanced in his life.
Where Mick Jagger plays God, presumably.
He is reunited with all these different women, and they regret their behaviour towards him and each other, and finally they live together in harmony. In the final episode, List and the women decide to fly down to Earth in a spaceship to destroy Wagner Hitler, who has now ravaged Berlin. And
Wagner Franken Hitler, please get it right.
Hello, we're the Wagner Franken Hitlers. Very old family. Once Wagner Hitler is destroyed, List sings that he is now fine. Peace at last.
Oh, sweet mother of Christ.
One of them, my suggestions for World's Worst Newsreader, doesn't publicly have their name announced because they only made one brief, very, very brief appearance on Doordarshan News, the channel in basically India's state TV channel, with a very fleeting freelance appearance in which they referred to the leader of China, President Xi Jinping, obviously Xi spelt X-I, as 11 Jinping. And was sacked immediately.
Amazing.
Three contenders to prove how bad they were. There was Growing Up Skipper from 1975. And
that's her friend, isn't it?
That's her friend, yeah. And they were like trying to make Barbie more young and relevant. So what they did was she was a kid, and if you twisted her arm, she would get taller and her boobs would grow.
What? That is not how puberty works. Because if it did, then I would have been pumping my right arm.
Weren't you?
The best thing about that is if you don't like how she looks then, you can just untwist her arm and she goes back to how she was.
The incredibly inflating and deflating woman.
So growing up, like, again, like Mattel trying to teach their, you know, their kids about how growing up works, but not doing that in any way at all. There is also Share a Smile Becky, who is one of Barbie's other friends. Who have you heard about her?
No, I just had an image in my head of it's basically a perfectly nice, normal, every woman, and she comes with two men in a white van who drive past going, give us a smile, love, give us a smile.
There probably is one of those, actually. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
Becky was their first kind of wheelchair accessible
doll.
So it's a girl who's a friend of Barbie's, comes in a wheelchair, and she was meant to be like a way to make... You know, they knew that they needed to make an accessible doll and something more relevant to today, and they were so on it, and it was a real big fanfare. But they didn't realise, they didn't make the wheelchair properly, so it didn't fit in Barbie's dream house.
I was literally about to say, I bet the dream house isn't accessible.
Didn't go in the dream house or the elevator. So, like, they made this thing that didn't fit, like, none of the things that she could play with were accessible, which is...
That is too perfect.
And the final contender to prove, like, Barbie is pretty rubbish but has tried so hard is computer engineer Barbie, who...
One of her many jobs.
Yeah, she's, like, she's been a busy girl.
Yeah.
She came with a little booklet. So she's got, like, a white coat on and she's, you know, she's a serious woman about town. She can, she can do computers, guys. What they did, though, in the booklet was she infects the computers with a virus and she needs her two male friends, Brian and Steve, to come and fix the computers for her because she can't do it. And it's like, they tried to make it so it's like, Barbie can do anything, she can do anything a man can do, yeah! And it's like, oh no, but she can't because Brian and Steve need to pop along as well.
Oh lord.
So I'm going to put Barbie out there as like, not fair, and there's a lot of reasons people don't like Barbie, I respect her and I like her, but Mattel just keep not, they just keep missing the mark, and that is why I'm like, get it together. Come on, guys.
I've just brought up her barbiemedia.com. She's
right,
had over 150 careers in the nearly 60 years she's been on our shelves, including registered nurse, rock star, veterinarian, aerobics instructor, pilot, police officer. She broke the plastic ceiling in the 1960s when, as an astronaut, she went to the moon 4 years before Neil Armstrong did. In the 1980s, she took to the boardroom as day-to-night CEO Barbie when women began to break into the C-suite. And in the 1990s, she ran for president before any female candidate ever made it onto the ballot.
She's ahead of her time in other ways, yeah.
She ran for president but didn't get the job, that suggests.
No, sadly not. There is a completely dedicated Wikipedia article to Barbie's careers, broken down into education, medicine, military.
Military? Where did she serve?
She's been an army medic, a paratrooper, United States Army officer during Desert Storm, the United States Air Force pilot, United States Air Force Thunderbirds, Marine Corps, and a petty officer.
She's done a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm worried that she's committed war crimes in Basra, to be perfectly honest.
In 1992, she became a rapper.
Oh my god, she's Marky Mark!
She's been a resort greeter at Disney's Caribbean Beach Resort. And a SeaWorld trainer. The worst of them all.
I can't wait for emotional breakdown, Barbie, when she's suffering from nervous exhaustion and PTSD.
I would suggest Hope Never Dies by Andrew Schaefer. I'm quoting largely from a review of it. Set some months after the 2016 election, when Joe Biden's favourite train conductor dies...
Oh my God. Oh my God.
As opening pitches go...
Wow.
Joe takes it upon himself to find out the truth. Good old Amtrak Joe. Joe Biden, a former vice president, famous for taking sort of the train to work from his home in Delaware. At the time, he's wrestling with mortality, how to still best serve the USA, and why Barack can't be bothered to call.
Oh my good Lord.
But wait, guys, because what good is a detective without a sidekick? With an entrance straight out of a James Bond film, Barack shows up to give Joe some secret lowdown on the conductor's death. It's a buddy cop movie starring the former vice president and president, guys. The twosome, with Secret Service agent Steve in tow, poor Steve, trying to get them to stop going to places and causing traffic jams.
Is that a nod to Bannon, or...?
I don't know.
Oh, God, I hope not. Like, sure,
I love the idea that there's one Secret Service agent, of course, looking after them as well.
Yeah.
They head off on a twisty adventure through the mean streets of Wilmington, Delaware. Encountering greasy diners, biker bars, dangerous life insurance investigators... An ambitious and dogged cop, tired of their shenanigans. She's a Republican, naturally. And one awkward night in a cheap, rat-infested hotel room.
The thing is, that's like my next purchase. Yeah. How can you not read that?
I mean, let's have a spin-off episode where we audiobook the shit out of this.
I'm all over that.
We can do the voices.
Well, yeah, because if we don't do the voices, then it's a shit audiobook.
I don't think the book will be as good as it is in our heads right now, guys.
I agree, but I also want to release the silent audio book.
As in, you mean John Cage's autobiography?
I don't know about you guys, but I miss the monarchy. I mean, you guys still have it. It's ceremonial. It's lovely.
Irish.
You guys never liked it.
Not massive fans.
But, you know, look at the real estate they leave behind.
Yeah.
What would you visit in India without the palaces? You know? You'd just it'd just be the Slumdog Millionaire set. But you go see Taj Mahal, you go see this, because there's a lot you can do. Without rule of law, unlimited resources, some general narcotics, and the will of a madman.
There are no tourists going on holiday to ancient Senate buildings, are there?
No, exactly. Medieval India, Emperor Akbar did not like a capital. He was bored with it. Moved the entire capital to another town. Made 1 million people walk. 200,000 people died along the way. They reach that capital, Fatehpur Sikri, realize there's no water, so they all move back. Another 200,000 people died along the way.
We shouldn't laugh at 200,000 people died, but this is bonkers.
This is perfect, because this is what you can do with the monarchy, right? The Mongolian Emperor Hulagu,
right, when he ran out of sport, decided that they wanted to play polo with the heads of camels.
Yep.
Yeah, and if you did not participate in the sport because you didn't like violence, you were killed. Now, that's how you build a fan base. That's how you build a fan base.
But my suggestion for the world's worst knight is Sir George Reresby Sitwell. And he is the father of Edith Sitwell,
right,
the author, and her brothers Osbert and Sacharel. Those names should be a clue as to this man's lunacy.
Yeah,
now, he lived from 1860 to 1943, an astonishingly arrogant man who lived in his own weird and wonderful world of inventions, scholarship, and hypochondria. And not only did he have hypochondria for himself, he had hypochondria for his children as well.
All right.
And at one point, he forced Edith to wear a back brace and a nose tunnel for no reason whatsoever.
To make her sit well.
Obviously. Nominative determinism has lived in this family for year upon year and century upon century. Amongst his many idiosyncratic inventions, he invented a musical toothbrush.
That's just a flute with a sting strapped to it.
An egg made of smoked meat and rice that was hidden within a synthetic shell.
Scotch egg.
Yeah.
Scotch egg, yeah.
And a tiny revolver for shooting wasps.
Did he invent a second one for shooting bees? Because they're very, very different.
Now, I guess you're wondering, have I fired five shots? I'll see. No, I'm sorry, I don't speak well.
We're going on a wasp hunt. We're going to catch a big one.
I missed the wasp and struck an innocent fly. I'll never hunt again. It's a ladybird holding another ladybird. Was aiming for the wasp. So sorry.
Then later, little hordes of ladybirds and ants and bees campaigning for gun control among the aristocracy.
Yeah, I mean,
all invertebrates matter.
Why don't you buzz off?
Like, most aristocracy like to hunt big game, but not old George Reresby Sitwell.
Oh, God, you didn't have a wall of, like, wasp heads.
Hang on, sorry, one second. How big was the gun that he could pull the trigger on it?
I don't know, it's probably one of those tiny little ones.
So then presumably has to wig up some sort of thing with string to pull the trigger on it? Or is it a massive gun with a tiny
bullet? Tell me where your nest is. Tell me where the nest is. Hang on, someone get me a cocktail stick, I can't cock it.
Or normal size gun, tiny bullet.
I can't load it, I've dropped them all.
Nobody move!
Nobody move. I think I've swallowed my gun.
There's two sex scenes from The List of the Lost. They are, like, to go back to your car crash, they are car crashes in a sense of they're terrible, but you can't look away.
Yeah.
So here's the first one. This is between two characters called Eliza and Ezra. The locked position when Ezra rubbed as far as he could go, the hump and bump of injection as his eyes met hers in equal swirl, guts and innards finally melting with intellect as jets of Ezra would cut in and then cut off at the moment when all of the body is felt from tip to toe, the leaden... Oh, that's my thing going off. That's a text from my mother.
As if this... She knew.
Darling, are you reading Smart?
There's a big red smut alarm above the kitchen hob at Maison Bernays.
Shut down the podcast.